Thank you, Stephen. Jolly in our radio facility, and good morning to our listeners through the Radio for the Print Handicap Network around Australia, and also through our traditional now internet stream. Let me commence this morning with a little reading to you. In Hobart's old woolshed, our flock will gather round to shear the fleece of burden so we can break new ground. We'll spin the yarn our way and take pride in our choice, but we'll always be united when they hear us raise our voice. Canes and echolocation, click, flick, tap, with dog guides and IRA to help bridge the gap. We won't be like sheep. I better read that again. We won't be led by like sheep, and unique will be our space. Our diversity and strength will make the world a better place. The writing of BCA's Poet Laureate, Steve Richardson. Well done, mate. So, with that formality out of the way, can I introduce one of my colleague directors, Stephen Belbin? And Stephen, I wonder if you could acknowledge the traditional lands on which we meet.
Thank you, John. Yama, Melia, hello, friends. My name is Stephen, and I'm a proud Aboriginal man. My people are the Barrabarigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney, New South Wales. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we're meeting on here this morning, the Muawina people, and also acknowledge any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people that may be in the room today. I'd also like to say that any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who are listening online, and acknowledge them, and certainly hope that they enjoy this stream. At this point, I'd like to also pay my respects and share my deep feeling with country to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, past, present and future. Thank you. Thank
you, Stephen Belbin. We have a room that is chock to capacity, 130 people in the room this morning, and of course other people working around the site. There's a team working in the radio room. There are our tremendous volunteers, people out on the registration desk. So we really have done well to bring such a great group to Hobart, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I do want to thank our Tasmanian branch, led by Doug McGinn originally and now Vaughan Bennison, for their great work in supporting this event. I also want to acknowledge our many special guests here with us this morning, and too many for us to name them all, but let me certainly highlight the fact that it's a thrill to have Senator Carol Brown with us. Carol is the Labor spokesperson for disability services, and she's been a great friend to the organisation over quite some time. It does help that she's in Hobart, and Emma Bennison does get home to Hobart from time to time, so they catch up. We have a number of representatives from our partner organisations, blindness service agencies, and I welcome all of you. We have people representing our various sponsors, and we'll hear more about our sponsors as we go through the day. So welcome to all of you. I also want to acknowledge our tremendous staff team who are all here. It's great that we were able to bring the full complement of 12 staff to Hobart, with the exception of Crystal Malcolm, who is home somewhat restricted in her travel because of her now, I think, about 2 months, 3 months old baby. So if you're listening, Crystal, we send our regards to you. To my board colleagues, thank you all for your support and the work that you're doing, not only with this convention, but throughout the year for BCA. Because in BCA, we are doing it our way, as the theme of the convention suggests. We take our own stand in how we develop our policies and implement those policies. We've been doing some of that work while we've been here in Hobart. There was a great meeting yesterday to further our advocacy work in relation to the negotiations with the Commonwealth Bank, the CBA, in relation to their Albert Terminal, and we'll hear more about that in the near future. We've also had other meetings. Emma and I were involved in a teleconference from here on Thursday, and we'll hear about that work as part of the session this afternoon. So lots of things happening as we do it our way. And one of the things that really is a strength of the organisation these days is the fantastic relationships that we've now built with blindness service organisations across this country. We have partnership agreements in place with Vision Australia, with Guide Dogs Victoria, Guide Dogs New South Wales, Guide Dogs Queensland, and it's great that those organisations are all represented here today. And we're building on that work, and this afternoon we'll see some of the fruits of the labour of our National Policy Council when we ask you to endorse our policy statement on expectations of service providers. And I just want to take the moment to say that's a very important piece of work because it's a piece of work that's designed to help our members to understand what they should expect from service agencies. So it's a document that's been developed specifically to meet the needs of our members. A lot of what is said in the document is already current practice in virtually all organisations across this country, but we felt it important to document that, and we hope that those things that are additional to what's currently happening, we will be able to add and encourage our service agency partners to move towards those things. There's nothing too onerous in it, and we'll talk more about it later, but it is an important piece of work. And Fiona Woods, the chair of our National Policy Council, along with other members of the NPC, have done some great work in that area. We, of course, continue to work in the area of audio description and had a fantastic workshop yesterday afternoon. And if the participants in that workshop are here this morning, I thank them for their support in that endeavour yesterday afternoon. Finally, communication. I've already mentioned briefly that this convention is being streamed via the internet, and we're using the support and services of the Radio for the Print Handicap Network, and particularly Vision Australia Radio based in Melbourne, to make our convention available to as many of our members around the country as is possible. 130 people here sounds good until you realise that that's a very small proportion of our membership. So I want to encourage those people who are listening to us to be part of this convention. Through the radio stream, we'll be promoting a mobile phone number, which is a text messaging number, that you'll be able to send in messages, particularly when we come to discussion and questions and answer sessions. So please, if you're listening at home, feel that you are part of this convention. I'm sorry we can't get the dinner or the barbecue to you, but there are always these physical limitations. But one of our key objectives is to make this organisation as easily available to its membership as we possibly can. And the final thing I want to say is that in that regard, we've done some great work and starting to do some great work in developing a cultural diversity group within our, or as a subcommittee of our board, to actually ensure that we are connecting in the most appropriate ways with people from a diverse range of backgrounds and cultural backgrounds and so on and so forth. That's as much as I want to say. Have we got our guest speaker online? We still haven't. Okay, in that case, I'm going to hand over to your host for this morning, Prue Watt, one of our directors. And Prue, I think we'll just need to proceed with Suman's presentation and then come back to the order of the program, which has the Australian Human Rights Commissioner, Ed Santo, as our first speaker. But we're obviously having a communications problem in getting Ed onto the video conference, so we'll work on that while we hear from Suman. And Suman, if you'd like to plug your HDMI cable in there, we'll see if it comes up on the screen. Okay, can I introduce, ladies and gentlemen, one of our rising stars as a director, Prue Watt.
Thank you very much, John, and good morning, everyone. So I would like to introduce and welcome very much our keynote speaker for the convention. But before I do that, I wanted to draw your attention to the title that's in the convention program. And it sort of is written as a formula of sorts, and it has a couple of abbreviations in it. So I thought I would just take a moment and explain what these couple of abbreviations mean. So this session is titled AI plus AR plus human equals beyond possibilities, with AI standing for artificial intelligence and AR meaning augmented reality. So these recent technologies, technological advancements have absolutely transformed and redefined the way that people who are blind or vision impaired access sighted assistance. To tell us more about these amazing technologies and how it is transforming people's lives, I would like to welcome and introduce our keynote speaker for the convention, Suman Kaniganti. Thank you, Suman. Before I hand over to Suman, I would just like to provide you with a bit of background. So Suman is the co-founder and CEO of Aira Tech Corp, an emerging high-tech startup currently focused on bridging the information gap for those who are blind or have low vision. Under Suman's leadership and guidance, Aira's service is comprised of leading technologies such as smart glasses, artificial intelligence, and augmented reality, integrated with a network of highly trained remote agents. Through this platform, Aira is able to provide instant access to visual information to anyone at any time, anywhere. Suman holds an MBA in entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial studies from the UC San Diego Rady School of Management and a master's in computer engineering from the University of Missouri, Columbia, and a bachelor's in electrical and electronics engineering. Under Suman's leadership, Aira has received some of the industry's top honours and awards, including being named Best Mobile Innovation for Education and Best Mobile Service for the Connected Life at Mobile World Congress 2019 Global Mobile Awards, in addition to being selected as one of Time Magazine's Best Inventions of 2018. An incredibly impressive resume. I would like to hand over to Suman now, and following this presentation, we'll have some time for questions. Please welcome, join me in welcoming Suman to deliver our keynote address today.
All right, how is everyone doing today morning? Yeah? Well, I flew in last night, and BCA gave me a wonderful opportunity to come down to this beautiful Tasmania. And this is my first time in Tasmania, and this is my first convention outside United States. So thank you, Emma, for inviting me to come and speak with you. I'm already enjoying it. I met a few of you last night, so it was wonderful. I also want to thank our partners, Vision Australia, who is in the room as well. I'm really excited. I'm really excited to be here. Why are we all here in this room today? You know, some of them are online, listening to the radio, but why are we all in this room today? What is the common factor that has brought all of us together? You know, are we here to celebrate success? Is it about learning new skills? Or is it to network with new people in the industry? Well, I believe that yes, it's all these things. But more importantly, I believe we are here because we are looking for a sense of belonging, togetherness, and community. Yeah? It's what we gravitate towards as humans, because nothing else can replace the power of human connection. At its core, Aira is a technology company, but everything we do as a company is driven by the values that we, as human beings, all share. Values such as respect, empowerment, pursuit of information. As humans, we all have this innate ability to seek and find and discover the information and knowledge in our environment. This is the basis of what we do at Aira. We strive to make the information that surrounds any individual instantly accessible. And we are motivated to take this to new, unprecedented levels. And that's why our explorers call our service the description of life. So let's talk about, you know, we talked about humans. Now let's talk about technology. Did you know the latest in the Aira? And thanks to the person before, they already mentioned AI stands for artificial intelligence, you know. And RA stands for remote access. So when we first came up with the idea of Aira, we tried to build entirely using AI. You see, the goal of this project was to give my friend who is blind, his name is Matt Brock, lives in Denver, Colorado, a way to discover new neighborhood independently, to find a shop and pick some flowers for his lovely wife, Dawn, and to do it all as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So we turned to AI to provide this capability. And however, AI can only do so much. It can only detect objects and if they are presented perfectly to a camera. But real life doesn't work that way. Yeah, so we are looking to change that. From detecting objects in the real world to providing thorough descriptions of an environment. It's all journey of discovery. It's a journey of learning and understanding the finite details and the associated context. Well, I am excited to say that we are now able to reach these greater levels of sophistication of AI. Because why? Because we have a human in the loop, and that is our Aira agents. Raise your hand or make some noise if you have experience working with an Aira agent. Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. So for people who haven't raised your hands, you should. You should try it out, because otherwise you are leaving experiences on, you know, behind at the convention. You came here for the convention for the experiences, so you should do it. Our agents are our product. Our explorers love to work with our agents. We are highly selective about who gets to be an Aira agent. Let's talk about it. First of all, agents need to be possessing very specific characteristics, such as communication skills, the ability to multitask, map reading skills, and the ability to be empathetic, not and never be sympathetic. We train our agents to think like a set of eyes, not like a brain. Because our agent's job is to provide you with the contextual visual information so you can make informed decisions and actions. We know why explorers love our agents, but did you know our AI developers also love our agents too? I mean, what do human agents have to do with the AI? Well, let me tell you, that's the beauty of it. Well, we are taking all these learnings we have gathered from interactions between our explorers and agents and using them to build a smarter AI. So, unlike anywhere else in the world, we are going to be able to deliver this context-based AI that has learned from our own explorers real-life behaviors and actions, which I think is beautiful. So far we have talked about humans, yeah, and we touched on the AI. Where does AR come into play? Because the whole session is about AI, AR, and humans coming together. Let's talk about AR a little bit. So traditionally, AR, the augmented reality, yeah, it's understood as the digital information that is integrated into your physical world. It's normally done via smart glasses with a heads-up display, such as a Google Glass or a Vuzix. Sighted people today are already overwhelmed by the amount of visual information in the world, which means visual augmented reality is more of a distraction than a meaningful source of information or interaction. And that's one of the reasons why Google Glass was not adapted by, you know, by general public. So AR in any form is computer-generated information that augments the physical world through one or more senses. So that's not just about the vision. That's not about the visual overlay. It's about when we augment a human using audio to interpret the physical world. It's called audio AR. So if you ask us what industry we are playing, that's the audio AR industry. We already employ audio AR technologies by having our agents, or even Chloe, which is our AI agent, interpret the visual world for our explorers and delivering the information via audio. Our augmented reality smart glasses, better known as Horizon, and I see a couple of them in the room, so thanks a lot for wearing them for me. it's awesome to see it. They are known as Horizon, and they do not have a heads-up display. Alternatively, they have a camera that is built into the bridge of the glasses to provide 120-degree field of view. These smart glasses also have Chloe, which is our AI, installed, whom explorers can interact, very similar to Alexa. And Chloe gets smarter every day. Why? Because it is learning every day from our growing base of explorers and the millions of tasks they conduct with our agents. So bringing all these major technology trends together, which is AI, AR, with a human in the loop, is what is truly needed to create a solution that pushes the boundaries beyond what we thought was possible. Technology should not be measured by what it can do for you. It should be measured by what you can achieve with it and what are the new possibilities that you can create with it. So on the note of possibilities, right? Let's talk specifically how our explorers are benefiting from Aira today. Let's split them into three main categories. One, education and employment. Today, around 400 students around the globe at over 120 colleges and universities use Aira to navigate their campus, read complex education materials, and to enhance engagement in their social lives. Our data shows a retention rate of 92% among the blind and low vision students who are incorporating Aira in their daily life, compared to the US national average of 40%. In this context, I am now pleased to announce that Deakin University campuses in Australia are now free Aira access location to all their students. Yep, it's pretty cool. Employment. Around 25% of our sessions are related to conducting tasks at work or for finding employment. We are tracking enhanced efficiency and increased opportunities for AI solutions to be effective. Organizations today provide Aira as a reasonable accommodation to enhance workplace efficiency. And we also have created what we call our Aira Employment Program, which delivers free service to explorers conducting tasks to finding employment, part of our mission to bringing unemployment rates in the community from 70% down to 7%. Number two, we talked about education and employment, and the second one is travel, navigation, and self-assurance, right? So we have what we call the Aira Airport Test. Raise your hand if you have used Aira at airport. Anybody here? Wow, one, two, three. That's pretty cool, four. And then five. There you go. Thank you. This is a nice cozy group today, but I have five explorers who did the Aira Airport Test. Why is this important? Because it's all about measuring the speed and ease at which an explorer can navigate a chaotic environment such as an airport from gate to gate to baggage claim to transportation. A number of explorers have told me it's about self-assurance. We now have a growing number of airports who provide free Aira access to blind and low vision travelers. Independent daily living task is number three. From cooking at home to shopping at the store, to reading a children's book, Aira agents and Chloe are always by our explorer side today. These are all the things that are happening today. Working together to do more every day. I'm pleased to say that to assist more people in more ways, we have a growing number of retail chains such as Walgreens, Target, who provide free Aira access to their shoppers. So those are the three verticals, if you will, that we are targeting: education, employment, traveling and self-assurance, independent living and quality of life. So I will conclude my remarks about Aira in Australia after I quickly show this 3-minute video.
How do we get the most out of our journey through life? Is it the pursuit of knowledge? An exciting career with a dream job? Or is it simply hanging out with your family, enjoying every moment as it happens? At Aira, we believe it's all this and more.
An explorer walking with her grandkids.
We believe that a key challenge of being blind is not lack of vision, but a lack of immediate access to visual information. So we're on a mission to provide instant access to information for anyone, no matter where they are in life's journey.
Explore shopping and grocery store.
Whether they are learning, job seeking, working, parenting, or just living their lives, Aira is there. At just the touch of a button, users, also known as explorers, are connected to remotely located, highly trained agents. Agent answers call.
Thank you for calling Aira. This is Rihanna. How can I help you?
Aira agents are immersed in the explorer's world via a patented virtual dashboard.
Agent accesses explorer's Facebook profile.
Learning. Only 40% of blind and low vision students finish college.
A lot of times blind students are marginalized after high school because college isn't always a practical option.
I can't even begin to tell you how many times I got lost when I first came to George Mason, trying to find my classes, and most importantly, trying to find the dining hall.
Job seeking. Up to 70% of the blind community is unemployed. Aira is committed to taking that 70% down to 7%. This program gives blind and low vision job seekers the ability to use Aira whenever doing tasks that will help them secure a job, like writing up a resume or accessing inaccessible forms online. Working. For those already employed, there's the Aira Employer Network, a collection of organizations that provide Aira services to its employees while on site.
Explore hands document to coworker.
Parenting.
I was able to have the agent help me watch him. I'd have him point on the word he was moving so that I can maintain and know that he was, you know, keeping up with the letters. And his reading level exploded.
You make people happy.
Yes, and you make people happy.
I'm baking cookies with my grandsons. Can you take a picture of them for me?
Agent takes picture of Explorer's grandchildren.
Living. Whether it's a simple task like finding something in the kitchen, shopping at a local store, or enjoying a special moment, Aira provides objective visual information that not only increases efficiency and saves time, but also encourages people to engage with their environment in new and meaningful ways.
Explore walks through Times Square.
I'm going to try to find my way to the outside, and then if you can call me a Lyft, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our rideshare integration means that agents are able to request rideshares, track drivers' locations, and ensure that users reach their destination.
Explore takes a Lyft.
Aira is growing their access networks by providing free service at their geofenced locations. Aira is a unique technology and service that empowers and emboldens those who use it. From school to jobs and from parenthood to grandparenthood, Aira is there, by your side, throughout life's journey.
Shot of New York City at night.
Aira, connected by AT&T. The description of life.
What do you guys think? And sorry for people who are listening on the radio, I just learned that the audio didn't come through. This video is available on YouTube, so I will make sure it is distributed, but otherwise you can just simply...
If we can get a copy, then we'll rebroadcast it on the radio.
Yeah, John says he will rebroadcast, so... Thumbs up to John. So moving on, Aira in Australia. So we are about to deliver more choice to Australia regarding Aira service. If you haven't already, you can download the Aira app today, here. Try it for free at the BCA convention. Once you go home to do the seven-day free trial. By the time you finish the trial, I'm pleased to let you know that we are, in fact, rolling in Australia the same range of plans that are available in the United States with billing in Australian dollars. And we are going a step further. We are going to start it from as low as $40 a month in Australian dollars. So I'm finally pleased to let you know that our Horizon smart glasses are also coming to Australia at the same time. So everybody will have that option. So... You know, all the things that you have seen on the video, if you were wondering, we have done, I'll throw some metrics, right? We have done 3.6 million minutes in the last 12 months. What does it mean? Our agents and explorers collectively have done tasks together for more than 70,000 hours in 12 months. So let's see what happens in the next 12 months, yeah? It's going to be great. People wonder what IRA is for, right? At the end of the day, simply put, it's the thing. Like, IRA is the thing that gets you to the thing, whatever it is. So I'm proud to have brought these unique industry trends together to fundamentally redefine the idea of equal access. And I'm proud that we are doing it in a brand new way that impacts every facet of life, as you have seen in the video, from magical to mundane, whether you are a student, working, traveling, or just living your life. Because after all, IRA is the description of life. I will take any questions now.
No,
all right, questions later.
Oh, thank you very much, Suman, for a wonderful and extremely fascinating keynote address, and also for delivering us that wonderful news. Apologies to those, again, listening on the radio and internet stream. And I know that we said there would be time for questions for Suman now, but there certainly will be. However, may I ask you to hold those questions in your mind for now. And we will now move to our presentation from Human Rights Commissioner Ed Santo. We will then have time for questions from Ed, and then we will come back to Suman for any questions from the floor.
Okay. Hello, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. My name is Ed Santo. I'm the Australian Human Rights Commissioner. I'd like to start by acknowledging the fact that you are all meeting on the traditional Aboriginal land of the Muwinina people. I'm quite a long way away here in Sydney, and I'm on Gadigal land, and I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging of both of those lands on behalf of the Human Rights Commission. I would have loved to have been there physically with all of you in Tasmania. And I'm really sorry that I can't be there. I've been on the road all of this week, but I was desperate to participate, and I'm really grateful that you've been so flexible in accommodating me remotely. I'm conscious that there's a vast array of really, really great speakers, and so I won't mention anyone by name, other than to particularly pay tribute to Emma Benison, who I understand is the principal organising mind behind this particular event. And, you know, I have enormous respect for the work that Emma does and her leadership, as well as the work that all of you do. So it's a real honour to be here. So I've been invited to speak about the project that I'm leading at the Human Rights Commission on human rights and technology. I understand, in fact, that a number of you have already participated through some of our consultation processes by listening to us and also by giving us really useful input to date. And so we're really grateful for that. Some of you may not have. So I might just start by giving a bit of background information. And then I want to, I guess, elucidate some of the themes that have arisen so far through what we've been hearing from the community. And I'll do that over about 15 minutes, and then there'll be some time for questions and comments after that. So I guess the background to this project is that we are really conscious that we're living in truly revolutionary times. It's been described as the fourth industrial revolution. And what marks that revolution is an exponential rise in new technologies, perhaps most famously, the rise of artificial intelligence, and it's changing everything. It's changing, frankly, what it means to be human, and that is exciting. And I'm certainly, in some ways, an enthusiast about some of these changes, but it's also hugely worrisome. Some of the changes that are happening are likely to, or already making our human rights less capable of being realised, and indeed going further than that, are actually infringing our human rights. So while I'm an enthusiast and an optimist generally, it's my kind of melancholy duty as Human Rights Commissioner perhaps to focus a little bit more on some of the threats and the risks. And that doesn't make me fun at parties, but it is pretty central to my role. So in the work that we've done so far, we've particularly focused on addressing what some of the risks and threats are, with a view to making sure that the opportunities are truly there. Because one of the, I guess, big structural problems is that if we're not able to address some of the risks and threats that are associated with artificial intelligence or AI, then we risk the entire technology becoming essentially toxic to citizens and consumers, and all of the positive things will be unavailable to us, as well as the things that we don't like. So I want to take you on a little bit of a tour about what we've been hearing. And I'm going to start in a place that I think all of you will already know very, very well, but I'm probably going to move into some places that that some of you will not have come across before. So one of the big themes that we've been hearing through our consultation has been about, what might be described as a philosophical choice in technology, whether technology should primarily be assistive for people with disability, or whether it should be I know most of you will be well aware of that distinction. Assistive technology tends to be a piece of technology that is dedicated to helping a person with disability be able to do a particular thing that they may not otherwise have been able to do. Accessible technology is technology that, that anyone can use, and it's designed in a way, of course, that is available to people regardless of their particular disability. So what was really, really interesting and frankly no surprise to myself or Alastair McEwen, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner, is we've been hearing really loud and clear that while there is a place for assistive technologies, on the whole, there should be a particular focus more accessible. One of the emblematic examples of that to date has been some of the discussion through the NDIS process about access to smartphones, such as iPhones. So there's been some controversy, as I'm sure all of you are aware, about whether that sort of technology should be available through the NDIS. The message that we're getting on the whole, loud and clear from our consultation process, is that it's precisely the sort of technology that people with disability in Australia are keen to access, and that there's also an economic imperative for that, that sort of technology, when it's designed well, can be, cheaper, it can be more readily available, easier for everybody to operate. It makes life in terms of interoperability with the wider community easier. That's a message that we've been getting loud and clear, and I suspect won't be a surprise to most of you in the room. So moving beyond that, one of the really interesting pieces of feedback we've been getting has been where technology has been developed, particularly technology that uses artificial intelligence, where accessibility may not have been at the heart of developing that particular product or technology, but that it has been a happy accident, as it were, that it might have some advantages in terms of accessibility for people with disability. So I guess two of the most obvious examples in that category would be some of the home assistant products. So there's the one by Google and the one by Amazon. Those are the two that are probably most the market leading product. So what we've been hearing, particularly for people who are blind or have a vision impairment, is that a product like Alexa can be really okay. I'm going to stop the video. I'm overhearing that there may be a bit of problem hearing me.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to drop the video, and Ed, that might improve the bandwidth because there are some dropouts in your presentation, which is unfortunate.
Okay, thanks, John. Jump in at any stage if you can't hear me. I realise I could easily get a real head of steam here, and I don't want to not very helpful. So I'm going to keep on talking. What I was starting to say was that you can have accessibility arise almost as a happy accident in some of this technology. The Alexa product is an example of that. It wasn't, speaking to those big technology companies like Google and Amazon, I'm kind of well aware of the irony of having technological difficulties when I'm talking about this topic. It's sad, but it's also, I guess, it's one of the things I'm going to actually come back to this issue because there's a serious part to it. So just to give you a teaser of the link, some of the promise of these new technologies we think has been vastly oversold. And so when we do have dropouts or that sort of thing, it's a reminder that perhaps we should focus on what the technology is actually delivering. Versions of the technology that may look more impressive than is the reality. Anyway, so another example of accessibility as a byproduct is self-driving cars. That's the other most commonly put out there example. And they're good examples, they're interesting examples. But what we have to remember, of course, is that if the genesis of those technologies is to pursue some other objective, not necessarily to make the world more accessible, then that will be central to the way in which those products are designed. And so there may be some advantages, but there are also often some disadvantages for people with disability. So I guess what that threw up for us is approach that is taken. What we've again been hearing loud and clear from many stakeholders has been the importance of a universal design approach or human rights by design approach. We perhaps all know examples of where that hasn't been followed. My former organisation, the example that perhaps is, and that's the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, which ran the case against the Commonwealth Bank involving the Albert machine. I'm sure you're all aware of that particular situation. That seems to me to be a really strong, powerful example of where a failure to take a universal design approach then meant that you simply didn't have a product that could be accessible to, in this case, people who are blind or have a vision impairment. And that we see as a huge problem. Without, again, wanting to teach all of you who are, many of whom are experts in these issues, things you already know, some of the key principles that are coming through to us about universal design or what we would call human rights. First, that this is actually something that's been talked about for some time, that it's not something that needs to be reinvented, but rather we need to start by understanding what the work has already been done in this space. So that means, for example, involving people with lived experience in the design process. I'm just going to pause there and just check that you can still hear me okay.
Yeah, it's still dropping out a little bit, but it's okay. Just continue on.
Ed, are you hearing
now me? Now I can't hear you. I can hear you, John.
Ed, are you hearing me now?
Yes, I can hear you, John.
Okay, we were hearing you, but you're not getting a return feed, is that right? Okay.
No, I am now.
Okay, fine. Keep going, Ed.
The principles for human rights by design or universal design are generally well understood. What we've heard in our consultation so far is the case for persuading companies and indeed even government to actually adopt that approach. That's the thing that made. And when you're making that case, and when we make that case, there are, I guess, two distinct elements to it. The first, and I think we should always start with this as the first, is that it's the right thing to do. We should always, you know, be motivated by principle more than just kind of pure pragmatism. And so that was a really, really important thing for us. And we were pleased to see in the consultation process we've undertaken so far that people said, well, you know, don't go straight to being pragmatic about it. Start because, you know, that's the right thing to do. And then the second part of making the case for universal design or human rights by design is sometimes referred to as the business case. Others might call it, you know, enlightened self-interest. That's the sorts of arguments that can be marshaled there are things like the fact that it actually can produce, and there's good research data on this, better design. In other words, if you take a cautious approach where you speak to all of the sorts of people that might want to use your product early in the design process, you're much more likely to get it right first time. And that's ultimately much more efficient than having to kind of reverse engineer solutions to make your product accessible after you've not just designed it, but you've actually made it. There are all too many examples of where that's happened, and the ultimate cost involved is great, but it's also frequently the case that whatever you come up with there is not as good as it could have been. We've also undertaken some really good research in partnership with some businesses that we think are leading the way in this area. To try and identify what are the commercial benefits of kind of catering to a diverse customer base. And we've looked at diversity in lots of different respects. So one of the respects we've looked at is in terms of the LGBTI community. So I'm completely separate from the question of disability. And I guess what came out really strongly from that partnership is that businesses find that if they are catering to the full diversity of our community, that actually works for them as businesses, that it opens up new parts of the market for them. But also it's more than that. It allows them to live out really good principles that the vast majority of their customers actually want to see them living out. And then another argument, if another argument were needed, is that, you know, companies have to reduce their risk of you know, negative regulation, which is a kind of a euphemism for saying no company wants to be sued. You know, so if you're in breach of disability discrimination law or some other law, then you're at risk. So far, the approach that we've heard that I've been summarizing, you know, so far this morning, has been fascinating to us, but it's also been unsurprising. What I want to do now, just for the last part of my remarks, is tell you some of the things that we heard that were entirely new to us. One of the things that's really interesting about the technology industry is there's a very strong culture that is known as the MVP approach. I grew up following a lot of sports. So MVP to me meant most valuable player, but in the technology industry, it means something completely different. It means minimum viable product. So the minimum viable product approach or MVP approach essentially goes like this. It's that if you're creating a new piece of technology, you shouldn't shoot for the perfect product first go. What you should aim for is something that is a very, very basic version of what you want. And then as soon as you've got that basic version, you just put it out there in the community, and you I guess, let it live in the community and see what consumer feedback is. And then there's a kind of a terrible overused word that, that's used in this space. You iterate. In other words, you make changes as you go. That is a very, very popular trend in the technology industry. What we've been really troubled by...
It's always when he gets to the most interesting point.
I'm just pausing there. It sounds like maybe I've dropped out again. Can you hear me?
You're back again now.
Okay. What we were troubled by in terms of the MVP approach is the notion that you could put out a product out there that is inaccessible to people with disability, but that nevertheless a company might see it as minimum or viable. We haven't said this publicly yet, but this is what I plan to say in our discussion paper that will be released in a couple of months. But first, it is completely unlawful to put a product into the community that is in flagrant. Matter. But secondly, I find it utterly offensive to think that your product is minimum or viable if you're essentially saying that at least initially you're going to make it unavailable to certain parts of the market that might be defined by their disability. It could easily be defined by their age or their gender or something else. That I think is not just unlawful, it's something that we should call out as being really, really bad practice. Mm. And then thirdly, the notion, even if you disagreed with me on the first two points, and I'd be surprised if you did, but even if you did, the third point is we're not convinced at the narrative that is, I guess, associated with this, which is that over time, the most accessible product will arise through that iteration process. I actually think that more commonly what takes place is that there may be changes that are made to the product over time, but it's much less likely that a really excellent accessible product will develop from there. It may be some kind of, desultory attempts will be made to make it less inaccessible, but that's very different from making it fully accessible. So the evidence, in other words, just doesn't seem to stack up with the narrative that that's what can arise. And so, as I say, I accept that the MVP approach is a trend that is very popular among technology companies, and that it is actually seeping into the rest of our culture. But what I think we need to do is push back quite strongly and say, look, what does this actually mean? And what does it mean in particular contexts where there can be genuine harm? And so that's something that we're really interested in pursuing a bit further. And so then the final point that I wanted to make is very specifically about artificial intelligence. And accessibility, and particularly in the area of image recognition. So I know you know already, all of know the applications that exist for smartphones, etc., where you can essentially hold up to an object or even a person, and it can tell you what that is, and sometimes even who that is. See my earlier comments right at the start. I'm not going to get carried away by that because that's not my job. My job is to look a bit more deeply at what some of the risks and threats are. So, but I do want to acknowledge that those things are really good. I just want to, before I, in order to explain what some of the risks and threats are, I just want to very, very quickly explain how that technology works. because it might sound like that, a term like artificial intelligence may sound sort of truly amazing and future focused and so on. And in some ways it is, but actually some of the core technology at the heart of that, or the core processes at the heart of that, are actually really quite simple, are surprisingly simple. So the way in which image recognition technology on the whole works is you feed into thousands and thousands of pictures, of photos. And it could be even, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of photos, but commonly a data set will be about... and those photos will all be labelled. Just going to double check. You can still hear me okay?
Yeah, it's still dropping out. Usually when you're okay. Saying something really interesting. But but continue on.
Okay, I'll get back to the boring stuff soon. So the way in which it works is that a human... will have gone in and labelled each of those photos. Really important thing to note, because when you're labelling a photo, if you're labelling a photo as, you know, that this is an app, not an evaluative question. But if you're labelling something with some kind of evaluation, like, you know, this person is... sad, or this person is happy. Generally, you know, when a person who is asked to perform that function, generally that's pretty straightforward, but you can make mistakes there. And those mistakes can be cultural as much as anything else. And then as you go further and further into more evaluative judgments, like this person is someone that you should trust, this is a trustworthy person, that then becomes very, very evaluative indeed, and reasonable minds can disagree about whether someone simply from a photo looks to be trustworthy. But what we're increasingly seeing in the use of image recognition is that those what we might describe as evaluative judgments are increasingly being used, and you get spat out. You know, just from someone's photo, a series of, I guess, judgments about them. And that then can be used in almost any, can be used in a law enforcement, financial institutions, pretty much any purpose that you can imagine, that's what's starting to happen. If you're interested in this, by the way, because I can't talk too much about this because I'll run out of time, but if you're interested in this, there's a really, really interesting piece of research that's been done out of Melbourne University. It's called the Biometric Mirror. So if you Google Biometric Mirror, you'll be able to find out a bit more information about their research project and some examples of the sorts of things that I'm referring to. Essentially, though, I guess what I'm worried about, or what we're worried about in respect of some of that image recognition technology and the directions that it's been taken in, is that it can be, frankly, deeply unreliable, and yet we, as humans, tend to be quite deferential. If the computer tells us this person, male, he's 18, and you should never trust him, we'll believe the computer about him being male and 18, and maybe the computer will be quite good at that. But whether or not we should trust him, that's a completely different matter. And yet we tend to be still quite deferential on that sort of question as well, which is really an anthropological problem. But it's one that is growing in significance. Now, the reason I'm bringing all of this up in a context of accessibility is that for people who are increasingly relying on image recognition technology, we need to understand really clearly where the limits of that technology lie at the moment. Because in some respects, there's, as I said, huge strides being made. But in many respects, there's an enormous amount of work that still needs to be done to make that technology reliable. And as I said, the Biometric Mirror project at Melbourne University is a really good example of sort of showing how it's being used, but how it's being used badly. And as humans, we also need to become, I guess, better educated in understanding what is a safe use of this technology and what is not. And that's a really difficult kind of process as well. So the last thing I would say, and this is really just my last sentence, is I mentioned before, we'll be putting out our discussion paper, which will set out our draft thinking in late July or early August, and then we'll do a second round of public consultation. So we would be delighted to hear more from people in that second round of consultation. We put out our draft recommendations for reform, very happy to take a few minutes of questions if that's helpful.
Yep.
Fantastic. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you, Ed. I'm not sure if my mic's on at the moment, but...
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. I just wasn't sure. There we go. Okay, that's better. Ed, thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. So we'll open the floor up for a couple of questions. We have a few mic runners, so they will find you. Okay, so if you can please stand or put your hand up high in the air so that the volunteers can see you.
Hi, thanks for your presentation and yet another inquiry into yet another issue for us, which is a positive. But I'll tell you what, nothing's going to happen unless we have a good LAW to back all this up. For goodness sake, anyone who wants to do something about banking problems, we haven't been able to. Audio description problems, we haven't been able to. People in cabs who get rejected by drivers with their dogs, haven't been able to. Seriously, we've got to get serious with law. So to the Tasmanian senator that's here, please ask Bill if he will, within 50 days of his new government, which I think he's about to form, introduce meaningful legislation with teeth. Thank you.
That's great to hear. And I did have a few more notes on my in front of me, which I wanted to kind of get to, but I thought I've already gone beyond what I was meant to say. I'm so glad you said that. I mean, one of the key messages that have come so far from our consultation is that we've got some legislation and some of it can be okay, but it needs to be amended and expanded and made better. The Disability Discrimination Act of my colleague, Alistair McEwen, who you'd all know, he's been, I think, really, really strong on this, that we need to work out how to make that work better for people. And the related issue that came up, again, which was really interesting, was, if I can call it this, sort of a kind of advocacy fatigue, where you're forced to argue and then re-argue the same case over and over and over again without making as much progress as...
Hi, Ed. Dan Stubbs here. Thanks for your presentation. I want to build on that last question. My mic's on. Dan Stubbs here. One of the things I know you're good at is dealing with government directly, often behind the scenes, and I want to know if you're talking to government, like the Attorney General and others, and are they listening? Because for a long time now, I think these issues of technology have been seen as a bit of a fringe issue, that's all very nice, but you know, it's not a genuine issue, but it's actually now creating genuine discrimination and pushing people with disabilities, particularly blind people, obviously, into into the margins and denying us genuine access. I remember hearing about this even when way back at the Sydney Olympics when we couldn't book tickets online and there was a discrimination case taken against the Olympics committee. And so all this is often seen by the mainstream as just a marginal issue and not really a big issue for people with disabilities, and it's causing major issues. Is government listening, is my question.
Yeah, it's a great question, Dan, and it's an interesting one. And maybe I can be really candid here. We at the Human Rights Commission obviously have a lot of different areas of human rights that we have to look at, and that's really important. Probably no big secret to say that in some areas we have more impact than... And so one of the reasons that we wanted to look at this through the lens of technology become, yet at least, a hugely politicised issue. And in other words, we feel that we're getting a more kind of interested hearing from government on some of these issues than perhaps in other areas. So I don't want to overstate my level of optimism, but it's certainly true that we had the chance to brief both sides of politics just over the last week, so that the government as well as the opposition, and of course we also briefed the Greens and minor parties too. Not every briefing goes particularly well for the Human Rights Commission, but these ones went really well. I guess what we were heartened to hear was that from both of the major parties that they were really interested in what's emerging from our project, that there are real opportunities, and we accept that and we embrace those real opportunities, but if we don't address the problems, particularly for people with disability, and others in the community, then those opportunities will prove completely illusory, and we won't be able to grasp those genuine opportunities. So I'm feeling generally pretty positive, but I also like to see the colour of their money, as it were. Nice words are one thing, but we'll need to see action on the ground, and that action needs to start very soon.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone, and thank you so much, Ed. I'm really sorry, but that's all the time that we have for questions. Ed, I'd like to thank you so much for your time this morning on behalf of everyone here at the convention and those listening on the radio and on the internet stream. Thank you very much for providing us with a really interesting update. We certainly wish you all the best in your continued work on the Human Rights and Technology Project, and the other work of the Human Rights Commission. So thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Ed, we really appreciate it. Okay, so I'd like to just briefly let everyone know that we're moving morning tea to 10:30, so we've got about another 15 minutes. With that time, I'd like to invite Suman back up to the lectern to take a couple of questions on his presentation.
Can I just remind people? Just particularly for the purposes of the people listening on the stream, can you please say your name before you speak? Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. It's almost like filling the accessibility gaps.
Hi, my name's Wayne Hawkins from Sydney. Thank you very much for your presentation. It is very exciting that we have this kind of technology. One of the questions for me that came up both from your looking, I just downloaded the app this morning and reading the privacy statement and then some of the comments that Ed just made in his presentation was around the information that IRA collects and stores. And, obviously machine learning doesn't work without data. But there are some things in the privacy statement that seem a little odd to me around the collection and ownership of the use of IRA. If you could just talk to questions about that, like why for primarily a paid service are you collecting and storing that data? And what are the protections so that that data is not hacked or...
First thing, right? I think partly whatever we do is for training and quality assurance. So I think the number one reason why some of the reasons we collect the data is for making sure we are adhering to the standards, and whenever there is any quality assurance that we need to double down on, we will do that. The second thing is, at the end of the day, you know, of course, we adhere to the individual privacy, yeah? So I think utmost importance, and if you think about our agents go through three-point background checks as well as confidentiality agreements, which is very strict policy. Even a one incident will lead to firing or letting that agent terminated. So we do have very strict policies around it. So at the end of the day, I think it comes down to what are the things that we are actually learning from the existing explorers. Let's just say a good example, right? So in the beginning, when Ira was forming, if you will, there was a photo feature. And the photo feature was made to take the high-resolution snapshot and zoom in for small font. But what we have learned from our existing explorers who've been using the photo feature is that they instead using the photo feature for taking good photos and uploading it to their Facebooks and sharing with their loved ones, right? So unless and until we understand that sort of behavior from the data that is derived from our own explorers, it's very hard to kind of continue to work on, you know, the higher levels of value propositions in this particular product. So, but ultimately it's into your hands. There is a privacy mode if you would not want agents to capture anything. And as well as you can tell the agents, you know, I would like to, not record the sessions or not record any data for this particular situation. So at the end of the day, you are still in control, but we use the data to understand and to increase the value prop of what we got to offer and enhance that quality levels. I think he was talking about the personal data.
That's okay.
Yeah, so...
Just continue on soon.
Uh-huh.
Just so much of the data that is in the privacy statement is personal data. What are the things that you do to protect that data? I mean, we hear constantly about hacks and information.
Oh, okay, sure,
you know,
yeah.
The government information is getting hacked. There's all across the world, the security of personal data is being violated. What is IRA doing to ensure that our personal data that is collected and stored is protected in a way that we can feel safe?
Right. First thing first, we do not collect any HIPAA-related information. There's no health-related information in there. It's more about your personal information about you know, what are the likes and dislikes when you go to a restaurant, for example. But besides that, you know, at the core, it's a tech company. So I have been responsible for PCI data at TurboTax that includes social security numbers of citizens of the United States. So we are hosted on AWS, and we, of course, thoroughly have pretty much all the greatest and latest encryption, and no individual person at even IRA, including myself, cannot view the personal information of that particular individual unless and until they are in that session with that particular agent to help out. So you know, there are there are policies from the technology standpoint, there are policies from the agents, and there are best practices and policies that we hand over to the explorer as well.
Simon, just yeah. A quick follow-up question. Australia is a fairly regulated, environment. And one of the things that's been coming up a lot for me, I reckon I should be being paid by IRA, actually, because I spend a fair bit of time trying to help you guys get IRA access locations here in Australia. And one of the things that continually keeps coming up is, look, if the data was stored here in Australia... I've heard this from a number of corporate entities. If the data was stored here in Australia, we'd be much more likely to be interested in becoming an IRA access location. So is that something that you've heard or that you would consider?
Two aspects in that. I mean, speaking of IRA access location, if somebody is asking about the data, we could literally have no data capture policies for a particular access location.
Okay, that's good to know.
So, for example, we have existing customers where there is no single data that is captured, but the system works and wonderful They're perfect. The only downside with that is we are not learning the understanding and the behavior of what's happening.
Yes.
Let's just take an example of campus, right? There are some campuses in the United States that will restrict us no record for, you know, all the reasons. So that's one. And then two, we are working towards being GDPR compliant at the end of the day, right? So I think it takes time, and we are a startup, and it's a matter of priorities and investments, and it will happen.
That's great. Yep. That's really good. Thank you.
It's Duncan Meerding from Hobart, speaking in Hobart. But both my questions kind of got kazumped then. I was going to ask about the privacy stuff, but you're talking about personal privacy. I run a small business around design and intellectual property. And if I was to work with subcontractors, often I hand them a subcontracting agreement, which is with effectively something that's very similar to an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. First of all, how would that work? And then the in terms of your service, I'm assuming it would be fine. But secondly, I've been trying to use online transferring systems for transferring funds recently internationally. The thing's totally it's not totally inaccessible, but vast portions of it isn't accessible, and I need a pair of eyes to basically do it. So I've been getting assistance with that. To what level does it work for something along those lines? Because that is pretty sensitive. How is the encryption in terms of those sorts of things? And then thirdly, I think we all are on the same page that we probably want those websites to actually just be designed properly in the first place. To what level has IRA ever been used as a, I don't want to use the word, but and don't take this the wrong way, but what level has it ever been used as a tool for companies to say we don't need to fulfill our requirements? Because I see it's a really good thing, and I'm actually thinking I'll probably try and sign up in a sec because I work in a fairly visual medium, and using your service would be amazing, but also I travel a bit and using your service would be amazing. But to what level do you also utilise your mentality in your company for universal access as well?
I'm writing all the questions in here. Oh, dear. Okay, all right. The first thing first. Yes, there are existing customers that are access providers today who, on top of our non-disclosure agreements that we have with our agents, we do also have specific NDAs with access providers. So call it your employer, your airport, or your park, or whatsoever. So I think when there is an opportunity, I guess whoever is the person dealing with you at IRA, you can request for additional NDA on top of it. And in regards to the universal access, I think I'm a big proponent of the universal access. And there is this, you know, we all talk about the accessibility, yeah, and we've been talking about accessibility for 30 years before even I was born. The way we define accessibility currently is somewhat limited to what technology can actually do. Like, for example, when we talk about the web accessibility, we always talk about, you know, built-in accessibility, and the website should be accessible, and, you know, the devices should be accessible. And even Mr. Chairman Edward kind of talked about, the universal design. One of the issues that I have, not necessarily with the universal design, but with the idea of the built-in accessibility, is you would have to keep up with the technology trends. So when you think about HTML framework that exists today, the alt text and the standards that exist now are being in establishment for more than 20 years. So when you think about all the developers out there in Silicon Valley, in Australia, in Sydney, and everywhere else, these people are trying to solve for maximum number of population by using the latest and the greatest framework. So unless and until the core and fundamental frameworks would evolve or would need to evolve along with the other technology trends that is happening in the industry, otherwise we keep on only, you know, chasing something that is too far away from us. So for us, the idea of universal design comes from solving for every particular problem without having to rely on the technology. And that's the reason why we have this human in the loop. We talked about AI. We talked about, and Edward kind of mentioned AI is still in the, you know, in the beginning stages. So the idea of understanding what blind folks today are willing to do and what are the challenges, and then using that behavior understanding and use technology to solve it, I think is super important. I don't know. I think I'm talking in circles, but I think we do have more than 20% of the company who are blind, including Jonathan Musen, who is actually in the room today. And we push heavily on bringing in kind of the latest technology design at the same time, bringing in the perspective from the community itself and balance out both the worlds very well.
Simone, Graham Innes. I'm an IRA explorer, and I loved walking along the Hobart waterfront this morning and finding out the restaurants, the names of the restaurants and other places that I was passing. It's something that, as a totally blind person, I've always missed. I did discover the Drunken Admiral. You'll be pleased to hear that I kept walking. But I wanted to ask you about the AI and the difference that for IRA explorers the Horizon glasses will make. What access to Chloe does that provide that isn't available just using the phone through the with the support of the IRA agents?
Yeah, good question. I mean, we do have best intentions to push Chloe onto the phone as well, but the thing with the Horizon is the following, right? It's about the usability. It's about, you know, picking up a piece of device and double-clicking, and you have what you need. If you think about, like, the design for Alexa or Google Home Assistant, what have they done beautifully? They have put together a device in your bedroom that you can say, hey, Alexa, and then that will respond to you all the time. And we want to create that sort of an experience for our explorers out there in the world. So the beauty with Horizon is it's always on, it's bootstrapped, Ira is running on it, Ira, Chloe is running on it, and all you have to do is double-click to get going. So as much as we would like to invest Chloe on your, you know, smartphones, there is a advantage, if you will, on how well we can do Chloe on our Horizon devices. And today it can read, and tomorrow it will do much more stuff. And in fact, the most exciting thing of 2019 is how much development that we will be pushing out on AI, because now I think our explorers has taught us what exactly to do there. And speaking of your story, I have one small story, which is one of the explorers told me, you know, he was navigating around the wands and he was shopping. And then he told the agent, it's like, how in the fucking world? I didn't even know that the Wells Fargo ATM existed in this wands. That's pretty wonderful. So, you know, these are all these things that happens on everybody explorer's life. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Simone. And thank you so much for being here with us this morning and for also attending the convention. On behalf of Blind Citizens Australia, we would like to present you with a gift that has actually been beautifully designed and crafted by Duncan Meeting, who asked a question just before. And so I'll just describe what the gift is. It's a small tea box. Oh, yeah, we could call our... so the gift is a small... unfortunately, yes. Would be great to call Ira, but unfortunately time is a little tight. So this gift is a small tea box that has been handmade from salvaged floorboards. It has a sliding lid on the top, and the box measures about 9.3 centimetres in height and about 8.5 centimetres wide. And it's made from Tasmanian eucalypt. So we really hope you enjoy that, Simon. And thank you.
It's beautiful.
Oh, I'm glad that you like it. And thank you very much again for your time. We really appreciate it. And we hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend. Excellent. Thank you so much, everyone. So, finally, that's about all from me, but I'd like to mention that we have quite a few sponsors here at convention this weekend that are listed in your programs, but it's now time to hear from one of them.
Vision Australia is a leading national provider of blindness and low vision services in Australia, supporting more than 25,000 people of all ages, life stages and circumstances who are blind or have low vision. We work in partnership with Australians who are blind or have low vision to provide the support and resources needed to live the life they choose. For more details, visit visionaustralia.org.
Vision Australia.
Blindness.
Low vision.
Opportunity.